Chapter 6. One Way In to Orgrun. The cook, who was always at the house very early, woke me up. I sleep sound, and he had to shake me and say in my ear, "Wake up! Wake up, Lord Estevan! Does a runner come from the king's house?" At last I understood him, and confused by sleep and urgency, got up in haste and went to the door of my room where the messenger waited. And so I entered, stark naked and stupid as a newborn child, into my exile. Reading the paper the runner gave me, I said in my mind that I had looked for this, though not so soon. But when I must watch the man nail that damned paper on the door of the house, then I felt as if he might as well be driving the nails into my eyes, and I turned from him and stood blank and bereft, undone with pain, which I had not looked for. That fit passed. I saw to what must be done, and by ninth hour, striking on the gongs, was gone from the palace. There was nothing to keep me long. I took what I could take. As for properties and banked monies, I could not raise cash from them without endangering the men I dealt with. And the better friends they were to me, the worse their danger. I wrote to my old Kemmering, Asha, how he might get the profit of certain valuable things to keep for our son's use, but told him not to try to send me money, for Tibby would have the border watched. I could not sign the letter. To call anyone by telephone would be to send them to jail, and I hurried to be gone before some friend should come in innocence to see me and lose his money and his freedom as a reward for his friendship. I set off west through the city. I stopped at a street crossing and thought, why should I not go east across the mountains and the plains back to Kermland, a poor man afoot, and so come home to Esther where I was born, that stone house on a bitter mountainside? Why not go home? Three times or four I stopped thus and looked back. Each time I saw among the indifferent street faces one that might be the spy sent to see me out of Erenrang, and each time I thought of the folly of trying to go home. As well kill myself. I was born to live in exile, it appeared. And my one way home was by way of dying. So I went on westward and turned back no more. The 3 days' grace I had would see me, given no mishap, at farthest to Kusaban on the gulf, 85 miles. Most exiles have had a night's warning of the order of their exile, and so a chance to take passage on a ship down the Cess before the shipmasters are liable to punishment for giving aid. Such courtesy was not in Tibby's vein. No shipmaster would dare take me now. They all knew me at the port, I having built it for Argovan. No landboat would let me ride, and to the land border from Erenrang is 400 miles. I had no choice but Kusaban, afoot. The cook had seen that. I had sent him off at once, but leaving, he had set out all the ready food he could find done up in a packet as fuel for my 3 days' run. That kindness saved me, and also saved my courage. For whenever on the road I ate of that fruit and bread, I thought, there's one man thinks me no traitor, for he gave me this. It is hard, I found, to be called traitor. Strange how hard it is, for it's an easy name to call another man, a name that sticks and that fits, that convinces. I was half convinced myself. I came to Kusaban at dusk of the third day, anxious and footsore, for these last years in Erenrang I had gone all to grease and luxury, and had lost my wind for walking. And there, waiting for me at the gate of a little town, was Asha. 7 years we were Kemmerings, and had 2 sons. Being of his flesh born, they had his name, Forth Remir Osborth, and were reared in that clan hearth. 3 years ago he had gone to Orkney Fastness, and he wore now the gold chain of a celibate of the foretellers. We had not seen each other those 3 years, Yet seeing his face in the twilight under the arch of stone, I felt the old habit of our love as if it had been broken yesterday, and knew the faithfulness in him that had sent him to share my ruin. And feeling that unavailing bond close on me anew, I was angry, for Ash's love had always forced me to act against my heart. I went on past him. If I must be cruel, no need to hide it, pretending kindness. Theram, he called after me, and followed. I went fast down the steep streets of Kuzaban toward the wharves. A south wind was blowing up from the sea, rustling the black trees of the gardens, and through that warm, stormy summer dusk, I hastened from him as from a murderer. He caught up with me, for I was too footsore to keep up my pace. He said, "Theram, I'll go with you." I made no answer. 10 years ago, in this month of Tua, we took oath. And 3 years ago, you broke it, leaving me, which was a wise choice. I never broke the vow we swore, Theram. True, there was none to break. It was a false vow, a second vow. You know it. You knew it then. The only true vow of faithfulness I ever swore was not spoken, nor could it be spoken. And the man I swore it to is dead, and the promise broken long ago. You owe me nothing, nor I you. Let me go. As I spoke, my anger and bitterness turned from Asher against myself and my own life, which lay behind me like a broken promise. But Asher did not know this, and the tears stood in his eyes. He said, "Will you take this, Theram? I owe you nothing, but I love you well." He held a little packet out to me. "No, I have money, Asher. Let me go. I must go alone." I went on, and he did not follow me. But my brother's shadow followed me. I had done ill to speak of him. I had done ill in all things. I found no luck waiting for me at the harbor. No ship from Orgrin lay in port that I might board and so be off Carhide's ground by midnight as I was bound to be. Few men were on the wharves, and those few all hurrying homeward. The one I found to speak to, a fisherman mending the engine of his boat, looked once at me and turned his back, unspeaking. At that I was afraid. The man knew me. He would not have known unwarned. Tibby had sent his hirelings to forestall me and keep me in Carhide till my time ran out. I had been busy with pain and rage, but not with fear till now. I had not thought that the order of exile might be mere pretext for my execution. Once sixth hour struck, I was fair game for Tibby's men, and none could cry murder, but only justice done. I sat down on a ballast sack of sand, there in the windy glare and darkness of the port. The sea slapped and sucked at the pilings, and fishing boats jogged at their moorings, and out at the end of the long pier burned a lamp. I sat and stared at the light and passed it at darkness over the sea. Some rise to present danger. Not I. My gift is forethought. Threatened closely, I grow stupid and sit on a bag of sand wondering if a man could swim to Orgrin. The ice has been out of Charasun Gulf for a month or two. One might stay alive a while in the water. It is 150 miles to the Argata shore. I do not know how to swim. When I looked away from the sea and back up the streets of Kuzaban, I found myself looking for Asha in hopes he still was following me. Having come to that, shame pushed me out of stupor, and I was able to think. Bribery or violence was my choice, if I dealt with that fisherman still at work in his boat in the inner dock. A faulty engine seemed not worth either. Theft, then. But the engines of fishing craft are locked. To bypass the locked circuit, start the engine, steer the boat out of dock, under the pier lamps, and so off to Orgrin, having never run a motorboat, seemed a silly, desperate venture. I had not run a boat, but rowed one on Icefoot Lake in Kerm, and there was a rowboat tied up in the outer dock between two launches. No sooner seen than stolen. I ran out the pier under the staring lamps, hopped into the boat, untied the painter, shipped the oars, and rowed out onto the swelling harbor water where the lights slipped and dazzled on black waves. When I was pretty well away, I stopped rowing to reset the stole of one oar, for it was not working smoothly, and I had, though I hoped to be picked up next day by an Orgata patrol or fisherman, a good bit of rowing to do. As I bent to the oarlock, a weakness ran all through my body. I thought I would faint, and crouched back in a heap on the thwart. It was the sickness of cowardice overcoming me. But I had not known my cowardice lay so heavy in my belly. I lifted my eyes and saw two figures on the pier's end like two jumping black twigs in the distant electric glare across the water. And then I began to think that my paralysis was not an effect of terror, but of a gun at extreme range. I could see that one of them held a 4A gun, and had it been past midnight, I suppose he would have fired it and killed me. But the 4A gun makes a loud noise, and that would want explaining. So they had used a sonic gun. At stun setting, a sonic gun can locate its resonance field only within 100 feet or so. I do not know its range at lethal setting, but I had not been far out of it, for I was doubled up like a baby with colic. I found it hard to breathe, the weakened field having caught me in the chest. As they would soon have a powered boat out to come finish me off, I could not spend any more time hunched over my oars, gasping. Darkness lay behind my back, before the boat, and into the darkness I must row. I rowed with weak arms, watching my hands to make sure I kept hold of the oars, for I could not feel my grip. I came thus into rough water and the dark out on the open gulf. There I had to stop. With each oar stroke, the numbness of my arms increased. My heart kept bad time, and my lungs had forgotten how to get air. I tried to row, but I was not sure my arms were moving. I tried to pull the oars into the boat then, but could not. When the sweep light of a harbor patrol ship picked me out of the night like a snowflake on soot, I could not even turn my eyes away from the glare. They unclenched my hands from the oars, hauled me up out of the boat, and laid me out like a gutted blackfish on the deck of the patrol ship. I felt them look down at me, but could not well understand what they said, except for one, the ship's master, by his tone. He said, "It's not sixth hour yet." And again, answering another, "What affair of mine is that? The king exiled him. I'll follow the king's order. No lesser man's." So, against radio commands from Tibby's men ashore, and against the arguments of his mate, who feared retribution, that officer of the Cusaban Patrol took me across the Gulf of Charsoon and set me ashore safe in Shelt Port in Orgrin. Whether he did this in Shifgathor against Tibby's men, who would kill an unarmed man, or in kindness, I do not know. Nasooth, the admirable is inexplicable. I got up on my feet when the Argata coast came gray out of the morning fog, and I made my legs move and walked from the ship into the waterfront streets of Shelt. But somewhere there I fell down again. When I woke, I was in the Commensal Hospital of Charsoon Coastal Area 4, 24th Commensality, Senethany. I made sure of this, for it was engraved or embroidered in Orgata script on the headpiece of the bed, the lampstand by the bed, the metal cup on the bed table, the nurse's yebs, the bed covers, and the bed shirt I wore. A physician came and said to me, "Why did you resist Dothi?" "I was not in Dothi," I said. "I was in a sonic field." "Your symptoms were those of a person who has resisted the relaxation phase of Dothi." He was a domineering old physician, and made me admit at last that I might have used Dothi strength to counter the paralysis while I rowed, not clearly knowing that I did so. Then, this morning, during the Thangan phase, when one must keep still, I had got up and walked, and so near killed myself. When all that was settled to his satisfaction, he told me I could leave in a day or two and went on to the next bed. Behind him came the inspector. Behind every man in Orgrin comes the inspector. Name? I did not ask him his. I must learn to live without shadows as they do in Orgrin, not to take offense, not to offend uselessly. But I did not give him my land name, which is no business of any man in Orgrin. Theramharth? That is not an Orgata name. What commensality? Carhide? That is not a commensality of Orgrin. Where are your papers of entry and identification? Where were my papers? I had been considerably rolled about in the streets of Shelt before someone had carted me off to the hospital, where I had arrived without papers, belongings, coat, shoes, or cash. When I heard this, I let go of anger and laughed. At the pit's bottom is no anger. I had been considerably rolled about in the streets of Shelt before someone had carted me off to the hospital, where I had arrived without papers, belongings, coat, shoes, or cash. When I heard this, I let go of anger and laughed. At the pit's bottom is no anger. The inspector was offended by my laughter. Do you not understand that you are an indigent and unregistered alien? How do you intend to return to Carhide? By coffin. You are not to give inappropriate answers to official questions. If you have no intention to return to your own country, you will be sent to the voluntary farm, where there is a place for criminal riffraff, aliens, and unregistered persons. There is no other place for indigents and subversives in Orgrin. You had better declare your intention to return to Carhide within 3 days, or I shall be... I'm proscribed from Carhide. The physician, who had turned around from the next bed at the sound of my name, drew the inspector aside and muttered at him a while. The inspector got to looking sour as bad beer, and when he came back to me, he said, taking long to say it and grudging me each word, "Then I assume you will declare your intention to me to enter application for permission to obtain permanent residence in the great commensality of Orgrin, pending your obtaining and retaining useful employment as a digit of a commensality or township." I said, "Yes." The joke was gone out of it with that word permanent. A skull word, if there ever was one. After 5 days, I was granted permanent residence pending my registry as a digit in the township of Mishnori, which I had requested, and was issued temporary papers of identification for the journey to that city. I would have been hungry those 5 days if the old physician had not kept me in the hospital. He liked having a prime minister of Carhide in his ward, and the prime minister was grateful. I worked my way to Mishnori as a land boat loader on a fresh fish caravan from Shelt. A fast, smelly trip, ending in the great markets of South Mishnori, where I soon found work in the ice houses. There is always work in such places in summer, with the loading and packing and storing and shipping of perishable stuff. I handled mostly fish, and lodged in an island by the markets with my fellows from the ice house. Fish Island, they called it. It stank of us. But I liked the job for keeping me most of the day in the refrigerated warehouse. Mishnori in summer is a steam bath. The doors of the hills are shut. The river boils. Men sweat. In the month of Acher, there were 10 days and nights when the temperature never went below 60 degrees, and one day the heat rose to 88 degrees. Driven out into that smelting furnace from my cold, fishy refuge at day's end, I would walk a couple of miles to the Kunderer embankment, where there are trees, and one may see the great river, though not get down to it. There I would roam late, and go back at last to Fish Island through the fierce, close night. In my part of Mishnori, they broke the street lamps to keep their doings in the dark. But the inspector's cars were forever snooping and spotlighting those dark streets, taking from poor men their one privacy, the night. The new alien registry law, enacted in the month of Kus as a move in the shadow fight with Carhide, invalidated my registration and lost me my job, and I spent a half month waiting in the anterooms of infinite inspectors. My mates at work lent me money and stole fish for my dinner.
so that I got re-registered before I starved. But I had heard the lesson. I liked those hard, loyal men, but they lived in a trap there was no getting out of, and I had work to do among people I liked less. I made the calls I had put off for 3 months. Next day, I was washing out my shirt in the washhouse in the courtyard of Fish Island, along with several others, all of us naked or half-naked, when through the steam and stink of grime and fish and the clatter of water, I heard someone call me by my land name. And there was Commensal Yegi in the washhouse, looking just as he had looked at the reception of the archipelagan ambassador in the ceremonial hall of the palace in Erenrong 7 months before. "Come along out of this, Estravan," he said, in the high, loud, nasal voice of a Miss Nori Rich. "Oh, leave the damned shirt. I haven't got another. Fish it out of that soup, then, and come on, it's hot in here." The others stared at him with dour curiosity, knowing him a rich man, but they did not know him for a commensal. I did not like his being there. He should have sent someone after me. Very few Argota have any feeling for decency. I wanted to get him out of there. The shirt was no good to me, wet, so I told a hearthless lad that hung about the courtyard to keep it on his back for me till I returned. My debts and rent were paid, and my papers in my hieb pocket. Shirtless, I left the island in the markets and went with Yegi back among the houses of the powerful. As his secretary, I was again re-registered in the rolls of Orgrin, not as a digit, but as a dependent. Names won't do. They must have labels and say the kind before they can see the thing. But this time their label fit. I was dependent, and soon was brought to curse the purpose that brought me here to eat another man's bread. For they gave me no sign for a month yet that I was any nearer achieving that purpose than I had been at Fish Island. On the rainy evening of the last day of summer, Yegi sent for me to his study, where I found him talking with a commensal of the Sekev district. Absol, whom I had known when he headed the Argota Naval Trade Commission in Erenrong. Short and sway-backed, with little triangular eyes and a fat, flat face, he was an odd match with Yegi, all delicacy and bone. The frump and the fop, they looked. But they were something more than that. They were two of the 33 who rule Orgrin. Yet again, they were something more than that. Politenesses exchanged, and a dram of Scythish life-water drunk, Absol sighed and said to me, "Now tell me why you did what you did in Sassenoth, Estravan, for if there was ever a man I thought unable to err in the timing of an act or the weighing of a Shifgrathor, that man was you." Fear outweighed caution in me, Commensal. "Fear of what, the devil? What are you afraid of, Estravan?" "Of what's happening now, the continuation of the prestige struggle in the Sinoth Valley, the humiliation of Karhide, the anger that rises from humiliation, the use of the anger by the Karhidish government." "Use to what end?" Absol has no manners. Yegi, delicate and prickly, broke in. "Commensal, Lord Estravan is my guest and need not suffer questioning." "Lord Estravan will answer questions when and as he sees fit, as he ever did," said Absol, grinning. "A needle hidden in a heap of grease. He knows himself between friends here." "I take my friends where I find them, Commensal, but I no longer look to keep them long." "I can see that. Yet we can pull a sledge together without being kemmerings, as we say in Eskev, eh? Of the devil, I know what you were exiled for, my dear, for liking Karhide better than its king. Rather, for liking the king better than his cousin, perhaps. Or for liking Karhide better than Orgrin," said Yegi. "Am I wrong, Lord Estravan?" "No, Commensal." "You think then," said Absol, "that Tibby wants to run Karhide as we run Orgrin, efficiently?" "I do. I think that Tibby, using the Sinneth Valley dispute as a goad, and sharpening it at need, may within a year work a greater change in Karhide than the last 1,000 years have seen. He has a model to work from, the Sarf, and he knows how to play on Argivan's fears. That's easier than trying to arouse Argivan's courage, as I did. If Tibby succeeds, you gentlemen will find you have an enemy worthy of you." Absol nodded. "I waive Shifgrathor," said Yegi. "What are you getting at, Estravan?" "This. Will the great continent hold two Orgrins?" I the same thought, said Absol. The same thought. You planted it in my head a long time ago, Estevan, and I never can uproot it. Our shadow grows too long. It will cover Karhide, too. A feud between two clans, yes. A foray between two towns, yes. A border dispute and a few barn burnings and murders, yes. But a feud between two nations? A foray involving 50 million souls? Oh, by Meshi's sweet milk, that's a picture that has set fire to my sleep some nights and made me get up sweating. We are not safe. We are not safe. You know it, Yegi. You've said it in your own way many times. I've voted 13 times now against pressing the Sinnoh Valley dispute. But what good? The domination faction holds 20 votes ready at command, and every move of Tibby's strengthens the Sarf's control over those 20. He builds a fence across the valley, puts guards along the fence armed with foray guns. Foray guns? I thought they kept them in museums. He feeds the domination faction a challenge whenever they need one. And so strengthens Orgrin. But also Karhide. Every response you make to his provocations, every humiliation you inflict upon Karhide, every gain in your prestige, will serve to make Karhide stronger until it is your equal, controlled all from one center as Orgrin is. And in Karhide, they don't keep foray guns in museums. The King's Guard carry them. Yegi poured out another dram around of life water. Orgata noblemen drink that precious fire, brought 5,000 miles over the foggy seas from Sith, as if it were beer. Absol wiped his mouth and blinked his eyes. Well, he said, all that is much as I thought, and much as I think. And I think we have a sledge to pull together. But I have a question before we get in harness, Estevan. You have my hood down over my eyes entirely. Now tell me, what was all this obscuration, obfuscation, and fiddle-faddle concerning an envoy from the far side of the moon? Genli I, then, had requested permission to enter Orgrin. The envoy? He is what he says he is. And that is an envoy from another world. None of your damned shadowy Karhidish metaphors now, Estevan. I waive Shifgrathor, I discard it. Will you answer me? I have done so. He is an alien being, Absol said. And Yegi, and he has had audience with King Argovan? I answered yes to both. They were silent a minute, and then both started to speak at once, neither trying to mask his interest. Yegi was for circumambulating, but Absol went to the point. What was he in your plans, then? You staked yourself on him, it seems, and fell. Why? Because Tibby tripped me. I had my eyes on the stars and didn't watch the mud I walked in. You've taken up astronomy, my dear? We better all take up astronomy, Absol. Is he a threat to us, this envoy? I think not. He brings from his people offers of communication, trade, treaty, and alliance. Nothing else. He came alone, without arms or defense, with nothing but a communicating device and his ship, which he allowed us to examine completely. He is not to be feared, I think. Yet he brings the end of kingdom and commensalities with him in his empty hands. Why? How shall we deal with strangers except as brothers? How shall Gethin treat with a union of 80 worlds, except as a world? 80 worlds, said Yegi, and laughed uneasily. Absol stared at me athwart and said, I'd like to think that you've been too long with the madman in his palace and have gone mad yourself. Name of Meshi, what's this babble of alliances with the suns and treaties with the moon? How did the fellow come here, riding on a comet? Astride a meteor? A ship? What sort of ship floats on air, on void space? Yet you're no madder than you ever were, Estevan, which is to say shrewdly mad, wisely mad. All Karhiders are insane. Lead on, my lord, I follow. Go on. I go nowhere, Absol. Where have I to go? You, however, may get somewhere. If you should follow the envoy a little way, he might show you a way out of the Sinnoh Valley, out of the evil course we're caught in. Very good. I'll take up astronomy in my old age. Where will it lead me? Toward greatness, if you go more wisely than I went. Gentlemen, I've been with the envoy. I've seen his ship that crossed the void, and I know that he is truly and exactly a messenger from elsewhere than this earth. As to the honesty of his message and the truth of his descriptions of that elsewhere, there is no knowing. One can only judge as one would judge any man. If he were one of us, I should call him an honest man. That you'll judge for yourselves, perhaps. But this is certain. In his presence, lines drawn on earth make no boundaries and no defense. There is a greater challenger than Carhide at the doors of Orgrin. The men who meet that challenge, who first opened the doors of earth, will be the leaders of us all. All. The three continents. All the earth. Our border now is no line between two hills, but the line our planet makes, encircling the sun. To stake Shifgrathor on any lesser chance is a fool's doing now. I had Yegi, but Absol sat sunk in his fat, watching me from his small eyes. This will take a month's believing, he said. And if it came from anyone's mouth but yours, Estevan, I'd believe it to be pure hoax, a net for our pride, woven out of starshine. But I know your stiff neck, too stiff to stoop to an assumed disgrace in order to fool us. I can't believe you're speaking truth, and yet I know a lie would choke you. Will he speak to us, as it seems he spoke to you? That's what he seeks. To speak, to be heard, there or here. Tibby will silence him if he tries to be heard again in Carhide. I'm afraid for him. He seems not to understand his danger. Will you tell us what you know? I will. But is there a reason why he can't come here and tell you himself? Yegi said, biting his fingernail delicately, I think not. He has requested permission to enter the common solity. Carhide makes no objection. His request is under consideration.